Welcome to VI Talk, sharing ideas, information, and support.
Hi, everyone. It's Jo, and it's a pleasure to welcome to the podcast Dave Williams. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Jo. Good to be with you.
Yeah, we managed to catch up at last. So, I know you've got, well, many things that you are involved with, but the reason we've got you on to speak this time is about your running. So, you weren't particularly a runner in your younger days, were you? It wasn't something that particularly you were into. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. I always tell people that 4 years ago, I couldn't run a bath. You know, that's basically the truth of it. And for most of my adult life, I didn't really engage with any physical activity whatsoever, you know, and I was eating all the wrong things and probably drinking too much and enjoyed the occasional cigarette. And you know, before we get into this, I just don't want anyone to think that, you know, suddenly now I'm really virtuous and that I'm doing absolutely all the right things, because I'm certainly not. But in running, I did find something that has massively transformed my life and how I think about my health and so many things.
So how did you first decide to put on those running shoes and give it a go?
Well, it was sort of by accident, really. I moved to Worcester in about 2006, so I was 30 then, and I didn't know anybody in Worcester at the time. I came because I was starting a job at Dolphin Computer Access, who people will know from Guide and Supernova and Easy Reader and all that stuff. And when I moved to Worcester, I was looking for things to do. And I remembered years and years ago when I was at school, I'd done a little bit of tandem cycling and I quite enjoyed that. And I thought, oh, that'd be quite good to do. So I fired off an email to British Cycling, who didn't reply for about, I want to say, about 6 years. And literally, that's not even an exaggeration. And so I didn't really do much for all that time. And in 2012, I had an email back from British Cycling saying, hey, Dave, are you still looking for a tandem pilot? Because we might have found somebody who will cycle with you. And so this guy came up from Cheltenham to meet me, a guy called Mike, and he said, yeah, I'd be up for doing a bit of tandem cycling. And I didn't have a tandem at this point, so I contacted Charlotte's Tandems, who can lend you a bike, and I went out, and then that kind of grew. I was doing a bit of cycling, enjoyed that, did a few sportives, Ride London, a few of the Heart Foundation rides, that sort of thing, and I cycled with lots of people. But you know, every so often, the person I was cycling with, they'd like move to Brazil, or they'd suddenly get injured or old, or, you know, stuff would just happen. And so I was really struggling to find tandem pilots, and I knew that blind people went running. And so I went on to the Find a Guide database, which is run by England Athletics and British Blind Sport, and put in my postcode. And I thought at the time, because I'd left Dolphin at this stage, and I was a freelance IT consultant. So my first reason for going onto the database was to try and find a guide runner and convert them into being a tandem pilot. And my second reason was that I didn't really believe that this database would work that well. You know, I thought there's bound to be a problem with it. You know, I'll find it and then I'll try and sort of sell them the solution, basically, because I was a freelance IT consultant at the time. And so I failed on both accounts, basically. the guide runner wasn't in the slightest bit interested in cycling. He just sort of replied. I said, after I put my postcode in, it came up and said, Steve is 3 miles away. And I thought, well, I better write to him, because if I hang around, Steve will be 4 miles away. So I wrote to Steve. Hi, Steve. This is Dave. Not interested in running, just testing the database. And Steve wrote back and said, are you free on Friday? To which I was like, no, you're not listening, Steve. I'm not interested in running. And he wrote back and said, I can be with you about 6 o'clock, what number's your house? Because he's got my postcode at this stage, because I've put it in the database. So he turned up, and this was the summer of 2018. I remember England were playing in the World Cup that year? And yeah, he turned up, and he was in his trainers, and he said, come on then, Dave, let's go. And I thought, oh no, what? So I had to go and sort of rummage around in the shoe rack to see if I could find some trainers. And so I put on some trainers, and we went out. And we were walking along, and he said, are you ready? And I said, no. And he started jogging. And it felt at the time like Usain Bolt had taken off, you know. And after about what must have been about 50 meters, I was bent over double, coughing my guts up. Couldn't believe what I got myself into. And he said, it's all right, Dave, we'll just walk for a bit. So we started walking. And when I got my breath back, I started to apologize. And you know, I'm really sorry, Steve, I've wasted your time. And this was a stupid idea. And he said, Dave, he said, you're talking, which means you can run. Let's go. So off we went again. And little did I know at this stage, Joe, I was doing Couch to 5K. He was starting me off on that Couch to 5K journey. And when we got back to the house, you know, he said, I'll see you next week. Wow. I said, you've got to be mad. So why would you want to do this? He said, well... He said, you're not going to get any better at it if you don't try again. So I reluctantly agreed to run again the second time. And we built it up. And the real moment, the sort of the epiphany, I suppose, was at the end of August. We went out. It was a bank holiday Monday early in the morning. And we were running for what felt like forever. And everything was burning and hurting. And I really wanted to stop. And Steve just kept saying, carry on, Dave, carry on. You've got this. You've got this. Go, go, go. You know, and we were going. And eventually we stopped. And he turned to me and he said, Dave, he said, I'm looking at my Garmin now. He said, and you've just run 1.1 miles. And at that moment, I thought, do you know what? That's a thing, isn't it? You know, because like running a mile, it's a metaphor. Yeah. It's a unit of this. It's not like you've just run around the block or you've run for the bus or something. You've run a mile, like a whole mile. And that had only taken maybe a couple of months or something. And I'm sure there are probably people do it quicker and maybe people take it longer. And I thought, well, if I can do that twice, you know, and if I work towards that, then I will eventually be able to run a park run, because a park run is just over 3 miles, 3.1 miles. So I stuck with it, and eventually I did get to park run. And the other thing he said to me at the time was, Dave, I need to introduce you to the running club, because I cannot run with you 3 times a week. Like, I've got other stuff going on, you know, I've got family and a job and everything. But clearly for you to develop as a runner, you need to be going out 2 or 3 times a week, really. So I was completely green. I had no idea. I was just learning as I went. And he said to me, is that all right? And I said, yeah. So he put a message on the running group and he said, I've started guide running with a chap called Dave. He can do about a mile and then needs to walk for a bit and then he'll run a bit more. Anyone up for it? And this lovely lady who lives about a mile away from me, who is actually a teacher at a local school, she put her hand up and said, yeah, I'll give it a go. And so she turned up on my doorstep. And the funny thing was that she's dyspraxic, so her left and right are sort of all over the place, really. So there we were, you know, a right old pair. She couldn't direct, I couldn't run. Somehow we just went on this incredible running journey together.
Fantastic. So do you still run with the same people? Do you still have the same guides?
Yeah. So I've got a bit of a network. I think, you know, if you are going to start running, you do need to build up a list of people, because one person can't do it all. You know, 3 or 4 people who are sort of the core team, if you will, of guys, and then maybe another half a dozen who are, you know, every so often.
That's amazing. And 4 years later, you're still doing it. You did indeed. You do have some stories to tell. So go on, tell everybody what you've done and what you're working towards, because I'm very impressed.
So I'd done the park run. And my first park run, I think it was like 32 minutes or something. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I know it was more than 30 minutes. And that's quite annoying when you've been running for half an hour and you're just over half an hour, you know, because then there's a little divil on your shoulder sort of saying, go on, you can beat 30 minutes, you can. So you've got to kind of go back. You feel like you've got unfinished business with it. So I kept plugging away at park run until I got under 30 minutes, and then of course it's about 29 minutes, and eventually, you know, you get down the times or whatever. And so over that winter, that 2018-2019 winter, I started running a little bit further, you know, and doing sort of 4 miles, 5 miles. And I got to a 10K, you know, and I thought, well, if I could do a 10K inside an hour, I'd be really happy with that. And I went off and I did my 10K, and I think it was 51 minutes. So I was really happy. This running thing, it's all going all right. And around that time, I became aware of a campaign by blind runners to encourage London Marathon to better recognize and celebrate the contribution of guide runners. People may not be aware that the medals at London Marathon given to guide runners used to be unofficial. It was just that the volunteers didn't know the rules and they'd just give the guide runner a medal anyway. So the medal was unofficial. They weren't included in the results either. And,
wow.
And blind runners felt quite strongly that this wasn't appropriate, that, you know, a guide runner, they do a load of training with you, they're with you before the race, during the race, after the race, they keep you safe, they keep other runners safe, they're essentially providing a service for the race organizer to make that event accessible and inclusive, and the very least race organizers could do to recognize that contribution was to include guide runners in results so that there's an official record that they actually ran the race. So to make sure that, you know, when they receive that medal, it is official, you know,
and yeah, this was coming absolutely. From blind
runners, you know, guide runners were far too modest. They didn't want this for themselves necessarily, but it was about what the blind runners felt that the least we could do as blind runners to give back. So I became really interested in this story and the reasons for it. And I was talking to people and there was a little bit of media coverage about it at the time. And then it kind of went a bit quiet. And I was, as well as the IT consultancy, I was doing a bit of freelance journalism, and I'd produced a few packages for In Touch. So, you know, you might have heard my voice on Radio 4 once or twice. And I contacted the then producer, Lee Kumutat, and sort of tried to pitch this to her. I said, well, you know, we should do something about this on In Touch, about this whole London Marathon thing, because, you know, blind runners really want to shine a light on this issue. And at the time, Lee wasn't that interested. And I don't know if she had like a slow week or something where there was not a lot in the program, but she called me up with very little notice and said, right, this guide runner thing, can you get me an interview with a blind runner and a guide runner? I said, yeah. And she said, right, and can you get them to explain why it matters? And I said, yeah, absolutely. She said, can you get that for me today? I said, yeah. Put the phone down, didn't know how I was going to do it. But yeah, eventually I spoke with Louise Simpson and Kerry Snell, and we put this piece together that went out on In Touch. And Lee called me, I was in the pub, and she said, just so you know, London Marathon have been in touch and they've asked the program to hold back this piece because they're having a board meeting next week and they're reviewing the policy. And she said, and I don't want to do that. She said, I want to run the piece. And if they want to send somebody on the program to defend their position, they're very welcome to do it. She says, I'm just letting you know that this has kind of gone up the food chain a little bit and the head of BBC Sport has got involved.
Wow.
So I came off the phone. I can't tell you how excited I was. I was, right, come on, let's get the drinks. We've got to talk about this guide running thing now, because people are rattled, sort of thing. And anyway, I came home a little bit worse for wear and got on the computer and I thought, well, I wonder what they do at other marathons around the world. You know, what do they do in Berlin or Tokyo? Well, I don't speak Berlin or Tokyo. So I went on the New York City Marathon website and found myself on the application form. Now, the way these marathons work is it's a bit like buying a raffle ticket. You know, you put your name in the hat, and they've got a limited number of places. And if you're very, very lucky, you might get one. And it's expensive as well. I mean, London is relatively cheap, actually, but some of these other ones are quite expensive. I filled in this for God alone knows, because I thought, well, I'm a runner now. I mean, you know, what do runners do? You know, they go and they run marathons. Of course they do. That's what they do. This was my drunken head talking, you know. And so I filled in this form, went to bed, woke up the next morning, thought, oh, my God, what have I done? I had proper buyer's remorse. I'd entered this ballot for this marathon in America. And I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll do nothing. I'll tell nobody about it. Nobody needs to know, because the chances are I'm not going to get in. And of course, a month later, the email lands in my inbox. Dear Mr. Williams, congratulations. You have a place in the 2019 New York City Marathon. And I thought, this is Steve winding me up. This can't be real. I haven't told him. How do people know about? Anyway, so I looked in my bank and I discovered New York Roadrunners had taken $270, because that's how much it costs to run the New York City Marathon.
Wow.
It's $10 a mile, pretty much. I thought, well, I'm going to have to tell somebody about this now. So I wrote to my guide runner and I said, I'm not sure how to tell you this, but I think I might have entered a marathon by mistake. I mean, bear in mind, I was only running 10K, so 6 miles. And even if you run a half marathon, right, the only thing that a half marathon and a marathon have got in common is the word marathon. A marathon is a completely different ball game. You know, I would say running a marathon is four times harder than running a half marathon. And so, anyway, I told my guide runner and she said, oh, I'd love to guide a marathon. Yeah, that'd be brilliant. Yeah, yeah, where is it? I said, well, yeah, about that. it's in New York. Oh, wow, that sounds amazing. Yeah, I'm up for that. I said, right, well, I better tell my wife.
So I told my wife.
And the thing I did have in my favour was the time to train, because this was February and the New York City Marathon is at the beginning of November. So I had 9 months to kind of get my act together and to do the training. So we went and we did it. And of course, the other thing that happened was London Marathon changed their policy in respect of guide runners. So they now officially recognize guide runners in the results, you know, not just, you know, down to the piece that I did, but lots and lots of other people were involved in that campaign as well. And you know, we should definitely recognize that. But yeah. I felt like if I was doing New York, then I should probably also do London, because that was kind of how this started. And of course, London Marathon is the one that we all grow up, you know, watching on the telly, and the one we all sort of know, you know, culturally.
Oh, yeah.
So I put in for that, and I'd started working for RNIB by this stage. So I said I would fundraise for RNIB. And so I did the London Marathon, and somebody said to me, you know, once you've done New York and London, you'll have done two of the six. And so my reaction was, what now? The two of the six, because that, you know, for somebody like me, that's quite provocative. You like, if you tell me I've done two of six of something, like, I, you know, I want to know what the other four. So it turns out there's a series, the Abbott World Marathon Majors, six big city marathons around the world. So they are New York, London, Boston, Chicago, Berlin, and Tokyo. And so in April of this year, I ran the Boston Marathon. So on my Strava profile now, it says halfway there, because I've done three of the six. And then the next one is Berlin, and that's going to be this September. The other thing about London Marathon, of course, is, you know, I ran New York in November 19. I was planning to run the London Marathon in April 2020. And of course, we all know why that didn't happen.
Yep.
And so they rescheduled it initially to the October of 2020. And then subsequently, they rescheduled it again to October of 2021. So I trained three times for that marathon, Joe. And I still feel like I've got unfinished business with it, because after training for it three times, I got there and got halfway around and sort of died a bit and thought, oh dear, you know, I've perhaps overcooked it, you know, and so I will go back and try and improve on things. So I'd never planned to become like a marathon runner. I did a couple in lockdown as well. So I've done five now, I think, in total, which, wow, you know, there are other people out there who've done dozens of the things, you know, clearly. But for me, as an overweight, you know, middle-aged dad who didn't start running until 4 years ago, I think that hopefully just sort of illustrates that anything's possible. And wherever you are, you know, in terms of your confidence about physical exercise, I promise you, I was absolutely you know, I would not run for the phone. You know, I wouldn't, if the phone was ringing downstairs and I was upstairs, I wasn't even running downstairs for the phone. I'll get it in a bit, you know. Yeah, I was the laziest person. Still am.
That's pretty amazing. And you were telling me when we spoke a couple of weeks ago that the marathons are very different, aren't they? So like where London, you know, people dress up in fancy dress and there's a lot of charitable stuff done, isn't there? And you were saying that like Tokyo is very different, isn't it?
Well, yeah. So I've not been to Tokyo yet. So I've that to look forward to. But the three locations that I have run in, they've all been very different. So New York was the first one, and my guide runner at the time, she said, you know, there are charity runners there, but very little fancy dress, for example. You know, we always hear about, you know, there's that Jasper Carrot routine about, you know, being overtaken by a rhinoceros and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, in the yeah. London Marathon, wasn't there a story a couple of years ago, somebody dressed as Big Ben got stuck under the finish gantry? You know, and there's always those kinds of stories. People do like pantomime horses and yeah. stuff like that. I think Vassos Alexander did it as a minion, possibly 1 year. So there's always those stories about people in these crazy costumes, and it's something about the British sense of humor, and I think it, you know, it speaks to our kind of love of slightly absurd things, you know, and panto and all of that, you know, that the London Marathon is this sort of carnival, really. Whereas you know, New York was more about the running, and Boston was even more about the running, because generally speaking, to get into Boston, you need to run a qualifying time. So it tends to be the cream of club runners.
Wow.
So the really kind of fast folks who go to Boston. There are some charity runners, but very few relative to the overall field. The other big sort of difference, I mean, they've all got amazing crowds. Don't get me wrong. You know, the support is just phenomenal. New York, you run over five quite significant bridges, because the New York Marathon goes through all five boroughs. So it starts in Staten Island. You then start over the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, which is this huge span that takes you across to Brooklyn and to Queens. And it's like taking off in a plane. So you're running up this bridge because you're so excited and the atmosphere is there, and you don't realize that you're actually running uphill. One of the aspects of the New York Marathon is they don't seem to always have barriers at the sides of the road. So occasionally you get people running across from one side of the road to the other, you know, because they want to be on a different side of the road. So you have that to look out for. And, you know, there are potholes, and there's one area where there are some orthodox Jewish folk who are not keen on the idea of the marathon, and so you have these rabbis, I think it is, who you know will kind of wander across the street, and you know, I've heard stories about people moving furniture across the street, you know, in the middle of the New York Marathon. The bit that's really sort of epic, I think, is where you come on to Manhattan, which is is, you know, where the Empire State Building is, and
yeah.
all the kind of famous things you know about New York, and you go up First Avenue, and that's the point where the crowds are at their loudest, and then you go out into the Bronx and everybody's sort of bashing their pan lids, you know, together. You know, the Bronx is a less affluent area, and certainly the nature of the support is different. You know, it's not people with tat that they've bought. It tends to be people who've just brought stuff out of their houses, you know, to make noise
yeah.
with, to support the runners. And then the finish is in Central Park. London, you know, I think people will probably know pretty well. You start either at Blackheath or Greenwich. And then at the halfway point, you come over Tower Bridge and you make a right and you run out towards Docklands. And that's quite hard, because at that point you see runners on the other side of the road who've already been to Docklands are on their way back. So they're quite a large number of miles ahead.
Yeah.
You know? And you think, oh, I've got to go all the way out there to come all the way back, you know. And then, of course, you know, the finish, you know, sort of along the embankment towards Big Ben, where you make a right in front of Big Ben. Those people who know London, it sort of comes past Westminster Tube Station, and then the finish, of course, on the Mall. And then Boston is the hilliest of the three that I've done so far, and I believe it's the hilliest of the six majors. Mm. The first half or so is downhill, and the thing that is really different about the Boston Marathon is you actually run to Boston. Only 10% of the Boston Marathon is actually in the city of Boston itself. You start in Hocklington, which is 26 miles west of Boston, and you run through you know, all these little towns, Framingham and Wells. So Framingham's a kind of a railway town, and you hear the trains there. We also had a fly pass as well. There was a Hercules went over just as we started the Boston Marathon. There was obviously the Scream Tunnels. This is a town called Wellesley, where there is a women's college, and all the girls come out and line the road and scream, and it's the loudest thing I think I've ever heard. And I ran that one with a mate of mine, Matt, and I said to him as we were approaching, I said, you do know once we get to Wellesley, I won't be able to hear either. Like, I just will be going completely on feel, because at that point, not only won't I see, but I just won't be able to hear a thing. The troubles in Boston kind of start at about 17 miles, which is where the Newton Hills begin. And there are four significant climbs between mile 17 and 21. Hills that, you know, most runners would probably be fine with on a normal day, but because of where they are in the marathon, you've already got 17 miles in your legs. You know, makes it tough. And then you finish in the city. So you start out in the countryside. It's beautiful. You run past lakes and under trees and all this kind of stuff. And then you finish in the middle of the city of Boston, on Boylston Street, which of course in 2013 was made famous because of the tragic events that year when two terrorist bombs exploded near the finish line at the Boston Marathon. And of course it's quite an emotional event, and because there are lots of memorials to that, not least of which there's a American elite athlete, Shalaney Flanagan, who actually ran with a Boston bombing survivor in this year's event. And people were trying to get autographs and things from Shalaney, and she said, no, this is not about me. I don't want photographs. I want to support somebody else so that they can run the marathon that they want to run, you know, which was just such a great showcase of what support running and guide running is all about. So
yeah,
they all are very different, and I'm looking forward to going to Berlin and running through the Brandenburg Gate, and who knows, maybe eventually I'll get to Chicago and Tokyo.
Absolutely, I think you absolutely will, because you are so tenacious, aren't you? You've just got the bug, haven't you? It sounds to me like you're just not going to stop till you've done it, which is fantastic. You know, really encouraging, I think, to anybody else who might be considering getting off that couch and doing the couch to 5K, even if you just achieve that, it's an achievement, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And you know, I would just start very, very small. Just think about making a brisk walk a regular part of your day. You know, just try at some point during your day just to get out, even if it's only round the block, or you know, to the post office or round the park or whatever it is. Just try and include some sort of walk you know, as part of your day. And you know what I've discovered about running actually is that mood follows action. Often we decide not to do things because we don't feel like it, or we're not in the mood to do it, but actually it's the action that creates the mood. So actually doing nothing, you know, maybe you've done your thing and you're just relaxing, and that's fine. But actually, if you do nothing for too many days in a row, you do start to feel down and you do start to feel isolated. And it's little wonder. But the point is that the mood has followed what you've done. So, you know, if you're somebody who struggles to get out, if you can find a way, whether it's the My Guide service from Guide Dogs, or whether it's using the Find a Guide database and doing Couch to 5K, or even just sort of getting a friend to go for a walk with, if you do that a few times a week, It will change the way you feel about yourself and about going out, you know, and your confidence will grow slowly but surely. And, you know, that happened, you know, for me, because I was the last person I ever expected would do any running. And quite honestly, I felt a complete prat at the beginning. You know, I felt very self-conscious. I didn't have the right shoes and I was going out. I had cotton. I mean, I just assumed that people just ran in a cotton t-shirt. Well, apparently they stopped doing that in the 1980s. And now people run in this sort of stretchy technical material, you know, but I just assumed that people ran in the stuff that we sort of did PE in, you know, when we were at school. Yeah. And nobody does, you know, everybody has this sort of stretchy, you know, lightweight, breathable material. And so, you know, eventually I sort of discovered that and I had help in finding the right kit and everything, and started doing a bit of reading. There are lots of resources online now. There are lots of people who are willing to answer questions. There's a VI Park Runners, you know, group, and of course there's VI Talk Sport. So there's lots of forums where people can ask questions, and of course British Blind Sport as well. So there's no shortage of information out there, and maybe running's not your thing, but find your thing, you know, try lots of stuff until you find something that really does float your boat. Because I wouldn't have known that I was going to enjoy running unless, you know, I had that experience with Steve encouraging me and just trying to get me past the difficult part to the point where I could actually start to enjoy it.
Yeah, I think we have to give a big shout out to Steve, don't we, for not letting you kind of just close the door and go, no, I'm not doing it.
That's it. You know? Yeah. So it's funny, you know, because I was struggling for a guide runner for Park Run this weekend, and he actually sent me a message this morning, and I haven't run with him for ages, and he said, you know, he said, I'm going to Mallard's Pike. Do you fancy it? And I said, yeah, I do. Yeah, come on, bring it on. So I'm actually going to run with him. And I said to him, you realize it's almost 4 years to the day since we started. So it's kind of our runniversary. So
fantastic. Happy anniversary.
Yeah.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, Dave. And really funny stories there. So hopefully you will come back when you've done all six and tell us all about it and what the others were like, because that would be really good to hear.
Would love to share that. Yeah, by all means. And of course, if anybody's got, you know, questions about running, or you're wondering about it, whether it's for you, or maybe you've started and you're struggling, you know, I think the best advice is just start small, take it easy, don't overcook it, because a lot of new runners get injured, and there are a lot of runners that they try too hard, and they push too fast, and they get injured. And I've seen this a lot, you know, and it's not a blind thing, it's just a thing about running, I think. And I am so paranoid about running because it's now become my release. It gets me away from the technology, it gets me off social media, it gets me outside, some fresh air, you know, if I just need that break. And you know, during that first lockdown, when we were told by England Athletics that you couldn't do any guide running, you know, that was like my worst thought there. And eventually I got a treadmill, and you know, I hated the treadmill. I've still got the treadmill, and I've made my peace with the treadmill now, because I know it gives me a degree of flexibility that I'm never going to have with a guide runner. If I want to go and run a specific session at a particular time or whatever, I can just go and do it on the treadmill, and I'm in control of that, and I can be independent. And I love my guide runners dearly and enjoy spending time with them. But I think, you know, it's important not to put all your eggs, you know, in one basket, because as soon as somebody's not available, then suddenly you can't do the thing that you want to do. And, you know, I think, you know, what VI Talk is all about, and many of the things I'm involved with is, you know, supporting blind and partially sighted people to live the lives that we want. And if you, you know, if you want to take up a, you know, an activity like running, you need to make sure that you don't put all your eggs in one basket. Don't become too dependent on one person. Try and build out that list of volunteers, because it will serve you well longer term.
That's really good advice, isn't it? And, you know, whatever it is that you're taking part in, you know, like Dave said, find your thing, whatever it is that, as I like to say, floats your canoe.
Yeah, that's the one.
You know, whatever it is, like you said, whether it's going for a walk, just getting out there, and because it does release those endorphins, doesn't it? And gives you that feel good. happy few moments, and hopefully that will then become a thing, and you'll, you know, enjoy it and continue to do it.
Absolutely. I mean, some people really love climbing, you know, Red Sail, you know, he climbs up these salt stacks and things in the middle of the sea. I don't quite know how he does it. You know, it terrifies the life out of me. I have tried a little bit of climbing, and I don't think it's me. I hope to get back to the cycling at some point. I mean, it's great cross training. And that's the other advice for runners, is to try and do a little bit of something else that's perhaps not as high impact, just to, you know, do the cardio, but without the impact on the joints.
Yeah, good advice. Yeah, brilliant. Oh, so if anyone does have any questions, you know, feel free to join VI Talk Sport and just ask your questions, because yeah, I'm sure there'll be plenty of people like Dave who are in there and who'd be happy to, you know, give advice and just answer those questions and give encouragement as much as anything, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, you're not alone. You know, remember that wherever you are on this journey, you know, I mean, and that was the thing that took me a long time as a blind person, really, to discover growing up, that actually, you know, in my early 20s, I really struggled to kind of find who I was, you know, and to make my kind of way in the world. And I sort of felt like, you know, my blindness was this sort of obstacle and thing that was going to prevent me from, you know, living the life that I wanted. And it was only actually when I started volunteering and eventually working for the American Council of the Blind that I met, you know, blind teachers, blind lawyers, blind accountants, blind journalists, blind athletes. You know, I was lucky enough to meet Michael Hinkson, who was the blind guy that survived the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center. We interviewed Eric Wagmire, who I think, you know, he was he the blind guy that climbed Everest? And so I realized, actually, there are all these incredible blind people out there, and you don't necessarily have to be like a marathon runner or an Olympian or whatever to participate or to benefit, you know, from getting out and doing stuff. And that was just really opened my mind to actually, do you know what? There's a lot for us out there, you know, if we are willing to have a go, and also accept that sometimes we are going to fail. You know, that's just reality. You know, sometimes you are going to fall on your face, and you've just got to pick yourself up and find a way to kind of learn from that experience. And, you know, I heard a pithy thing on the radio this morning, but I think there is a grain of truth in it. Is you know, if you're not failing every day at something, then you're probably not trying, you know?
Yeah, and I'm a great believer in occasionally getting out of your comfort zone, and I do try and do that myself, you know. And you know, for me, I'm not a dancer by any stretch. I would never class myself as a dancer. I usually describe myself as a bar proper upper, you know. And and we've decided to do dance classes for VI Talk starting in July, hopefully. And I've got a friend who's a visually impaired dance instructor, or was, and she's happy to do it again. And I went as the guinea pig to see how this would work, you know, with the technology and everything and all of that. And I thoroughly enjoyed my little self.
Amazing. Yeah.
You know,
we did some before we got married. We wanted to do the first dance, and neither of us could dance. We booked these lessons, you know, and we said to the lady, you know, we're both blind, by the way. And anyway, we went for like 6 weeks or something, and we learned to do this dance. And then on the wedding day, we realized, oh, shoot, we haven't practiced in the wedding dress. So, yeah, we stumbled our way around the dance floor. But you know what? It doesn't matter. We had a go, and it's memorable, and we still kind of laugh about it now. And, you know, it's all right to get it wrong and to make the mistakes and all that stuff. You know, just I think we're quite hard on ourselves sometimes as blind people. We hear about these, you know, sort of incredible blind people who've done all these amazing things. And I think we feel like, oh, well, if we're not absolutely smashing it out of the park, then, you know, then we're not kind of up to, you know, up to scratch or whatever. And you know, that's it's a difficult way to think, actually, that, you know, you just have to, if you do more than you did yesterday, you know, when I go for a run, right, I'm not going to win park run or whatever, you know, or the marathons or anything like that. In fact, out of the 50,000 people that run, you know, some of these big city marathons, there's probably only about 20 people who actually stand any, you know, cat in hell's chance of actually winning the thing, right? So it's not about winning. Clearly, it's not, because you know, the vast majority of people there are never going to come close to that. But it's about challenging yourself and maybe improving on what you did last time, you know, and getting into the occasion and the event and appreciating the crowd. And you know, I sort of reluctantly agreed to putting my name on my shirt. I didn't really want to do it, and everyone said, no, you got to put your name on your shirt. You got to put your name on your shirt, because then, you know, in the photographs and all that kind of thing. You know, I was like, oh, really? No, I don't know if I want to do that. And anyway, I did put my name on my shirt and went to Boston and ran in the marathon. And I remember at one point this guy going, "Dave Williams, all day long, Dave Williams." And I just thought, yeah, that's how long it's going to take me, you know. But it really just made me smile that somebody had seen that, you know, and wanted to kind of be supportive, you know.
Yeah, so, it's lovely, isn't it? It's great. And like you say, it doesn't matter, does it? It doesn't matter whether you do it, whether you're a whatever, you know, sub 3 hours runner, or whether you take, you know, 5, 6, whatever hours. It doesn't matter, does it? Because it's an achievement.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm somewhere in the middle for the record. I'm just over 4 hours. So I've got that thing, you know, I said about park run earlier that I just over 30 minutes.
You want to be quicker.
Well, I'm just over 4 hours, and I've done these 4-5 marathons now, you know, including the sort of the lockdown ones, and they've all been just over 4 hours, and I'm sort of knocking on the door, you know, and hoping that one day I might just sneak the 4 hours. I hope I do.
Next time we speak to you, when you've done the 6, then
we'll see.
You know, when you've been to Berlin and Tokyo and Chicago, is it? We want to hear all about it, and I'm sure you'll have got under that. You'll have sneaked under that 4 hour.
We'll see, yeah. 3:59:59, we'll do it.
Absolutely, doesn't matter, does it?
Nope. Do you know, the other thing is, if you do ultra running, so some people think that a marathon's not far enough, and I don't really understand these people, but there are some people that do it, and so you can go off and run 50K or 100K or whatever. And the interesting thing about ultra running is that nobody asks you what your time was, because nobody cares. Like, when you go up to a marathon, people say, well, yeah, but how long did it take you? What was your time? Actually, if you do an ultra run, nobody cares. Maybe if I don't get under my 4 hours, I should start ultra running, and then nobody will ask.
Oh, Dave, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it. I love talking about running, and I like encouraging other people to you know, just give stuff a go. And even if it's not running, you know, find your thing.